Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, the predictable, awful effects of life in a declining empire. That's us. With insightful commentary by Chris Hedges and also Mark Crispin Miller. I hope you'll stay tuned. Here are some ideas I got from political scientist Michael Parenti a few decades ago. Turns out, these ideas are argued by today's speakers, too. Empires are formed for the economic benefit of a country's elite. Empires benefit the average citizen, if at all, only marginally and briefly. As time goes on, empires require more and more resources to maintain. After a while, the resources plundered from foreign lands no longer pay the cost of keeping the empire operating. So elites of the imperial power continue their plunder at home. Methods of repression developed for use in the colonies are brought home to keep the citizens subjugated. And as the empire continues to collapse, all of the political and cultural institutions of the metropolis rededicate themselves to preserving the elite rule at the expense of the citizens. Again, that's America today, in the view of Chris Hedges and Mark Crispin Miller, and increasingly in my own view, too. So, for example, the Democratic Party becomes a tool of Wall Street and the corporate elite just as much as the Republican Party is. As Chris Hedges notes today, it is impossible for a citizen to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. Impossible to vote against endless war abroad. For both Hedges and Miller, the differences between Trump's principles and Biden's are small. Both candidates have earned the Fortune 500 seal of approval, we might say. Let's start with Chris Hedges. Here he is, interviewed by progressive economist Richard D. Wolff on August 31st, 2020.
Is the American empire, or is the American century, or however you want to call it, is it now in decline? Is there something happening or some set of things that are happening that qualify for such a phrase to be used? And if you think so, what are the signs that say that to you?
Well, there are physical manifestations of decline of empire all around us, and we are dying in the same way that empires throughout history have died. The assault against urban centers, that's actually a characteristic of dying empires. The decrepit infrastructure, the abandonment of whole sectors of the population, the hollowing out of institutions that are unable to deal with the stresses that are put on a country. So the foundations rot away, the facade remains. And I think the pandemic, of course, is one of those stresses we've lost, or because of this for-profit healthcare system, because of the ineptitude of the Trump White House, but I think we have to go back for, you know, decades. The kind of assault on the healthcare system is hardly tied exclusively to the Republicans. An estimated 300,000 Americans will be dead by December, possibly 400,000 by January. Real unemployment, as you know better than most, is not at 10 or 11%, but because of the way they fix the numbers, upwards to perhaps 20%. Ever since 2008, there's been assault on the incomes of American households. The average middle-class family's net worth is more than 40,000 below what it was before the crash of 2007, 2008. And of course, people of color suffer worse. Black families are down 40%, Latino families 46%. And now we're watching as the unemployment benefits, the supplemental unemployment benefits are withdrawn, the moratoriums on evictions and foreclosures, and a real ruthless assault against American families. I mean, before this pandemic, 4 million people were being evicted a year. Before the pandemic, 1 in 4 tenant households spent half of its pre-tax income on rent. Before the pandemic, we had some 2,000 unhoused people sleeping in their cars, sleeping, you know, on bridges, on city streets. 27 million people are expected now to lose their health insurance. And just to close, the capitalists have reacted. They know what's coming. Banks are not lending, but like my bank, Wells Fargo, I know I shouldn't be at Wells Fargo, is just a complete moratorium on any kinds of loans because they need to stockpile reserves of cash for the wave of bankruptcies and defaults on mortgages and student loans and car loans and personal loans and credit card debt that they know is coming. So we're headed for a social and political dislocation within weeks, if not months, that we haven't seen since the Great Depression. All of that are symptomatic of an empire in deep distress, unable to deal with any kind of stress that's put on a system that's been essentially pillaged by a global capitalist elite that you have been one of the most prominent voices in pointing out.
Chris, here's a question that arises when people think about the network of things you just mentioned. How do you understand that at the same time, everything you said is the reality for the overwhelming majority of the people? At the top, we have a government that celebrates a booming stock market that has more than recovered from the depths of the pandemic crash in March of this year. And here's what I'm after. Do we have now a kind of classic collapsing empire ruling class that is so besotted with the accumulation of ever more that they've lost all sense of the reality around them, that they are, if I can borrow the old phrase, somehow busily killing the goose that laid the golden egg that they've stolen from everyone?
Yes, that's also a characteristic of dying civilizations, as Joseph Tainter pointed out in his book, The Collapse of Complex Civilization. So you have an elite that, as you correctly pointed out, severs themselves from reality. Remember that the oligarchs who now control both our financial and political system don't live in America. They live in a bubble of their own creation. A New Yorker writer called it Richistan. They don't fly on commercial airlines. They don't have any contact with the working class. They associate only with their own tiny elite. There was an article in the New York Times a little while ago that pointed out that productivity within the American workplace had increased by 77% since 1973, but hourly pay had only gone up 12%. This is the New York Times. And they said that if the federal minimum wage was attached to productivity, it would be more than $20 an hour. Instead, what you have is a third of the workforce, and this was before the pandemic, earning less than $12 an hour, and most of them do not have access to employee-sponsored health insurance, which of now, of course, many people are losing. An estimated 27 million people, because they've lost their jobs, are expected to add to those without health insurance. So what you have seen, and again, you've been one of the most important voices on this, is this assault by a rapacious oligarchic, global oligarchic elite that has brought us to this point. And what they've done, of course, the pandemic has not only swollen or bloated the stock market, but the bank accounts of the billionaire class. I think one of the last figure I read was the ruling billionaires have increased their wealth by over $500 billion. You know, Jeff Bezos is, the last figure I read was increased by $30 billion. So yes, because of our money-saturated elections, because lobbyists write our legislation, because the courts are controlled by corporations, there's no redress for the citizenry. And this has essentially created a system where, I mean, most of these corporations engage in tax boycotts. Amazon didn't pay any federal taxes last year. In fact, they got money back, but they're hardly alone. I mean, Bank of America, on and on and on. There's no check. This is why Marx calls capitalism ultimately a revolutionary force. There's no internal or external check on their pillage and their greed. And this is now having very, very dire social and political consequences, which are playing out in front of us.
Do you think the election will make any difference to this scenario we're discussing?
No, because, I mean, the problem with the elections is that, and this election is no different, is that it's all reduced to personalities. And it's really based on fear. You know, you vote for Joe Biden because of the fear of Trump. Biden himself is not offering anything other than the kind of continuum that got us into this mess. In fact, of course, Biden was one of the architects of neoliberal policies and endless war. I mean, I think you should be clear, we should be clear that, you know, it's not just voting against Trump. You are voting for something. And, you know, I teach in a prison. We can begin with the Violent Crime and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, which Biden pushed through, which gave over $30 billion to police and prisons. Biden pushed all the death penalty issues. He was one of the architects of NAFTA. He was one of the cheerleaders of the war, and go all the way back to his misogyny in terms of going after Anita Hill. He was a segregationist. He's had many times called for assault on Social Security. Look, there is no way within the American political system to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. So whether you have the more civil and palatable face of Biden or the narcissistic, divisive, racist rants of Trump, the actual system of corporate power is untouched.
And would you say that the Trump versus Biden is also a symptom of an empire declining, that in moments of crisis like this, this is the best you can come up with?
Yeah, of course it is. And let's be clear that Biden was selected by the Democratic oligarchic elite. Figures like Lloyd Blankfein, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, and others made very public that if Bernie Sanders, to a lesser extent Warren, but particularly Bernie Sanders was the nominee, they would vote for Trump. So the whole least worst issue only applies to me and you. It doesn't apply to them. And so they anointed Joe Biden because Joe Biden serves their interests in the same way Trump does. And in that sense, the political and economic system is completely fixed. I want to add that it's not a solution, because a continuation of the kinds of policies the Democratic Party has, after Clinton sold out to corporate power, has imposed on the American people is inevitably, and I think history bears this out, going to result in a fascist with brains, a competent fascist.
What do you see as positive going on? What hope is there that we can find a way forward other than the trails marked out by the Republicans, the Democrats, and all of that?
Well, the street protests, and I think what has struck me about these protests, and triggered by the kind of indiscriminate police murders disproportionately targeting people of color, well, African Americans in particular, is that there's a sophistication. They aren't being gaslighted by Nancy Pelosi in a kente scarf, or police taking the knee, or Muriel Brower, the mayor of Washington, painting in 35-foot tall letters Black Lives Matter in front of the White House at the same time she calls for a $45 million increase in the police budget and the building of a $500 million new jail. They're not buying it. And that kind of gaslighting by the elite, and in particular by the Democratic Party, isn't working. So any hope comes from sustained mass civil disobedience, the kind of uprisings, and it's interconnected because neoliberal economics is global, that we've seen around the world, Lebanon, Chile, and everywhere else. That's where the hope lies. And I think there is an understanding, in my sense, of those who are leading these movements, that they grasp that these are systemic problems that have to be addressed. They're not reduced to the political personalities of Donald Trump or Joe Biden.
Now on to Mark Crispin Miller. Miller is a scholar of rhetoric with a particular interest in the techniques of propaganda. In this interview from May 2020, he does not explicitly state that the American empire is collapsing, but he describes the same symptoms that Hedges does. His interviewer is John Barkhausen. As we join the conversation, Miller is discussing the concept of conspiracy theory. True fact, this concept was invented and disseminated in the 1960s by the CIA itself, in order to shut down any public discussion of the truths of the Kennedy assassination. Mark Crispin Miller.
Whereas starting in 1967, it's used more and more, and more over the ensuing decades, through the other assassinations, through 9/11 and so on. And always in the same way, always to discredit people who are raising questions about possible state crimes against democracy, which is Lance DeHaven Smith's concept, state crimes against democracy. So, you know, it's used in a particular way, and it's used more and more, and it's been so successful that we have all internalized it. We have all learned to be a little guarded about expressing our suspicions, right? No matter how well-founded or well-informed those suspicions may be, we often feel we have to say, well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but, I mean, that's something you hear people say all the time. So yet you have to kind of learn to trust your suspicions once again, because it's not only natural, but healthy and necessary in a democracy for people to assume that elites are up to no good. The very, very rich and powerful will act in their own best interest. They will try to take our rights away. They will try to put limits on our freedom. They will try to take our money. They'll try to take our Social Security because they are pathologically greedy and power mad. I mean, that's the nature of power. This is not an original insight of mine, you know?
It's always funny to me that it's so powerful, but I think it triggers a fear of ostracization, if I'm saying that right. From your fellow human beings, and it just really cuts to the core of all of us.
Well, that's absolutely true. Propaganda isn't just slanted facts, disinformation, fake news, whatever you want to call it. It isn't just that kind of dubious content that comprises propaganda, but it's also a way for you to establish your identity as a member of a certain collectivity, you know, as a member of the mass that you identify with. So liberals are really dangerously susceptible to what we call the liberal media, just as a lot of people on the right are susceptible to the Murdoch Empire's propaganda. But both sides, liberal and conservative, do tend to fling that phrase around, conspiracy theory.
Do you want to talk about politics for a minute?
Sure.
We have elections coming up in November. Most of the people up here, I'm from Vermont, and most of the people here, many of them supported Bernie. And I think we were all very disappointed when what looked like a rapid rise to the nomination was just delivered a swift and deadly blow. And he went down and immediately started cooperating with Biden. And I was just wondering what your take is on Bernie and the whole election phenomena in this country.
Well, I was a big Bernie supporter. I think Bernie was the people's choice in 2016, and I think it was 11 primaries were stolen from him, and that Hillary was the beneficiary of those thefts. 2016 was the year that election theft, you know, finally brought forth its most poisonous fruit, because you had Hillary running against Trump when it should have been Bernie running against Trump, because Bernie would have beat Trump, I think, walking away.
I think so.
And Trump didn't actually win in 2016. At least, let me simply say that there is copious forensic evidence that the three swing states that he seemingly won were actually stolen. His own team didn't expect him to win. Their own polling foretold a defeat. That's why he went to bed early on election night. And I found out from that guy, Anthony Scaramucci, that they didn't even have an acceptance speech drafted. Okay, they had no expectation he was going to win.
Wow.
I think it came as a huge surprise to him and Melania, who looked horrified. I mean, it was right on camera. But he wanted to go home and start planning his own TV network, I think, is what he wanted to do. But yeah, he was chosen by whoever makes these choices. Then Bernie runs again, right, as you've said. And to me, it's abundantly obvious that he was robbed again. You know, he was screwed out of the Iowa caucuses. You know, I didn't really think you could steal a caucus, but they managed to come up with a phone app.
That's right.
Took care, right? I mean, which completely unnecessary, but it threw the outcome into doubt and enabled the myth that Buttigieg had beaten Bernie. Now, the kicker for me was Bernie's losing the Massachusetts primary. That was the thing that really floored me, that Biden won the Massachusetts primary. Now, just a few days before that primary, there was a poll by one of the TV stations in Boston which showed Bernie in the lead with, I think it was 25% of the vote. Warren was, and it's her state, remember,
yeah,
Massachusetts. Warren was second with, I think, 17%. I mean, these numbers, that people should check them. Biden came in fifth in that poll. He had 9%. Okay.
Yeah.
And then he wins the primary? Are you kidding me? I mean, who could possibly believe this, right? So what does Bernie do? And this is the guy I supported, remember? Bernie folds, as you say. Bernie just completely caves. Bernie doesn't raise any questions about the vote. He had never taken any precautions against a repeat of what happened in 2016. You know, the theft of those primaries was documented chapter and verse in this 109-page report called Democracy Lost from an outfit called Election Justice USA. There's no doubt about it. It's completely obvious that it was stolen. By whom, we don't exactly know. We know that the vote suppression was carried out by the Democratic National Committee, but the electronic fraud was probably the work of Republican operatives, because that's their specialty. And they didn't want Trump running against Bernie, right? They wanted Trump running against Hillary.
Yeah.
So what does Bernie do this time? Nothing. He does nothing. He waltzes into the primary process as if what happened 4 years before hadn't happened. And this is when I started to wonder about him, to distrust him. Now, Jill Stein, bless her heart, after the 2016 election, forthrightly and properly raised funds to do forensic investigation of the vote counts in the three swing states that Trump won. And she found a lot of further evidence that he didn't really win them. You may remember, she was excoriated for this.
Oh, yeah. She was a Russian operative,
because there was a picture of her sitting at a table, the same big table as Putin at some event. I mean, I spoke to her. I mean, she had to get herself a police dog. I mean, she was like public enemy number one. Oh. Well, Bernie wasn't going to do that. Bernie has never taken that risk. He's never put himself out to preserve the democratic process. So, you know, as soon as he immediately folded and vowed his allegiance to Joe Biden, who, for my money, is kind of hard to differentiate from Trump, except he's a bigger phony. Trump is at least an overt, straightforward ape. Trump doesn't do lip service. Trump is the face of U.S. power without the mask on. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Biden will make these meechy and unconvincing semi-progressive noises and talk about people at the kitchen table and all that crap. This guy is completely corrupt. He would cut Social Security. He would bend over for the Pentagon.
Yeah.
He would vigorously destabilize foreign governments. He is an obvious racist. He is also a sex offender. I happen to believe Tara Reid, who is another much maligned figure. But here he is running, and Bernie is backing him, and even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is backing him, but she's another phony, too. She stands with the junta in Bolivia, right? She attacks Maduro's government in Venezuela. She's another one of these fake progressives like Ilhan Omar, our first Somali-American congressperson, who has recently hailed the Pentagon for striving for greater transparency and accountability in its drone bombing of her native country. Okay.
Wow.
These are our progressives, the squad. These are our progressives. I mean, this is breathtaking to me, but it just goes to show that we don't really have a left in this country anymore. It's all about social justice, posturing, pronoun policing, yeah, taking down statues of Confederate war figures. That's all symbolism. That's all theater.
But
that's
not
well, they're not going after the elites. They're all kind of funded by the elites themselves. So it's all part of the pro wrestling match that we were talking about before. The squad are that side of the wrestling match that we cheer on. And Trump is the side we boo. You know, it's ridiculous.
And somebody pointed out recently, and maybe you know who this is, but they were saying that the left appears not to be interested in actual power. Like you say, they're
right. That was Matt Stoller in that great interview that Journeyman Pictures did.
Yeah, that was very insightful.
Yeah, it was a great interview because here's a guy who was, you know, a big D Democrat, very proud and dedicated, and has come to see that it's a charade. And as you note, he makes this point that the left isn't interested in power. They're not interested in elite power. He says they do art criticism.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great line. You know, it's true. They do art criticism. They focus on what people say and their gaffes, you know, and whether they have the right assortment of persons of color in their immediate orbit.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who will be overjoyed if Stacey Abrams or Kamala Harris becomes Joe Biden's running mate, you know, as if that will make any difference whatsoever. It's really amazing.
Mark Crispin Miller on our corrupt economy and corrupt political institutions. Nicely complementing and echoing Chris Hedges' observations that we heard earlier. And on that gloomy note, we must end this installment of New World Notes. You can find all of our installments on our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, reminding you, and reminding myself, that in solidarity there is strength, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Till then.